podcast is part of the Pod Syndicate family. For more criminally compelling shows, articles, and conversations, head to wearepodsyndicate.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this bonus episode on the Chinstroker versus Punter feed. Paul is not joining me for this bonus episode, but I believe that his absence will be more than compensated for, because as listeners will know, we are long-term fans of American science fiction epic Babylon 5. So we've recently had two out of three of the lead actresses from the show, namely Pat Tallman and Claudia Christian. And I'm happy to say that we've now completed the trilogy, as we have one of my favourite actresses of all time, Meera Furlan, joining us.
So thanks so much
for joining us, Meera. How are you today?
Thank you. Lovely words. So kind of you. Thank you. Thank
Absolutely. My pleasure. It's great to have you here. Where in the world are you today? That's a question I've been asking people a lot recently because of all of the madness that we're finding ourselves in.
I am in Los Angeles, sitting in the garden of my house, and I'm, you know, grateful every day that I have a little piece of land and a little piece of grass and a little piece of, you know, earth and some trees and so on, because it's been weird. It's been strange being inside. But I'm, you know, I'm debating right now with myself, you know, whether to travel to Europe to finish this play that I was doing when the whole, you know, catastrophe struck. And I came back on the 13th of March. I came back to America, you know, on the last flight before the ban of all European flights that, you know, so it was all very dramatic. So now I'm thinking, is it time to fly? And I'm, my whole being says no.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's very little precedent for us to look back to for guidance in this, is there?
Exactly. You don't have any guidance. So it's up to you. You know, I don't know. You ask your friends, nobody knows. You ask the authorities, nobody knows. I mean, who do you, how do you know what to do, right?
Absolutely.
Are we overcautious? Are we not, you know, are we not cautious enough?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I suppose this question of geography and movement is something that you know a lot about, Meera. I mean, you yourself, you're from obviously the former Yugoslavia, where you had a very successful career in theatre and both film and television, including, I've got to say at this point, a real favourite of mine, Emir Kusturica's When Father Was Away on Business.
Yeah, that's a beautiful movie. Yeah.
And that's one of those films where I can't imagine it being made. It just feels like a film that just kind of appeared fully formed out of the ether, and I was just wondering if you could tell me a little bit about your experiences on that film, because it's one that I've adored for a very long time, and it was, I mean, at the time there was and even now there's a lot of buzz about that film. I mean, I believe it was nominated for an Oscar. It was the Palme d'Or winner. Can you tell me a little bit about your experiences working with Emir and your experiences on that film?
Well, you know, as an actor, you always have a very, very intimate experience, your own personal little angle, right? And for me, things were tough at that shooting, you know, for many, many reasons. But the movie came out great, and I'm very happy that I was a part of it. But it's interesting, you know, the success of the movie and even the quality of the movie is not necessarily linked with your own memory, you know, of the experience that you had. And sometimes, you know, you had this lovely and wonderful experience with the people, with your collaborators, with the director and so on a movie that comes out and is horrible. And then you had a really bad experience on a movie that is wonderful, or a TV series.
That's so interesting.
Many of those.
That's so interesting that you might end up with a film where the result is perhaps artistically not what you were hoping for, but you've got a wonderful home movie of a wonderful experience. And are you able to separate the two in your mind, particularly when, for example, and I understand, for somewhat obvious reasons, considering the content of the film, what you're speaking to there, but if you've had perhaps quite a grueling experience making a film, but then the result of the film is something that's so rewarding to have been a part of, are you able to separate those two things in your mind when you're viewing the film as an audience member?
It's very hard. You know, it's very hard. I usually don't like to watch anything that I'm in. just because of that, you know, because your own internal intimate experience overwhelms you and you can't really judge it as a work of art, right? You know, all these personal relationships. And also, you know, we had a horrible, you know, path in the former Yugoslavia with the war and so on. And many people took, you know, a different side than what was my feeling about the war and so on. And the director of that particular film, you know, took a completely different path that I couldn't understand. I couldn't justify it in my mind. And so, you know, we are all very divided. It's very sad. Very sad when I think about it, you know, and also that movie, that particular movie, you know, was the last movie, or maybe one of the last, but I would say the last big Yugoslav movie, right, with an all Yugoslav cast that came out of all these different communities and different states, me from Croatia, other people from Serbia, many people from Bosnia and so on. So it was, you know, it's very sad when I think about it, you know, how it all collapsed and how it all, you know, went through this self-destruction kind of phase, you know, that never stopped, never ended there. So it's hard to think about that without that knowledge and without that experience.
I mean, of course, I'm very interested in the space of your career for a number of reasons, because, I mean, you must feel like you have had a career of two halves, or I suppose a life of two halves in many ways.
Yeah.
I mean, you as a lot of listeners will probably know, we've got a lot of Babylon 5 fans in our audience. We've also got a lot of fans of European cinema as well. I mean, it's well known, of course, that you left Croatia in the early 90s into quite dramatic circumstances. And I don't want to get into that too much, because I know that you spoke to that in many venues. But what really interests me about that is I understand that you're looking for, I suppose, the right venue or the right mechanism to tell that story yourself. And I was just wondering if you could tell us, I suppose, a little bit about this experience and the transition, but also any potential projects that might be coming out of that. I know that you've spoken in the past about your interest in writing about that experience.
I wrote a book. Yeah. It's done, more or less, you know, what is ever done. And, you know, whenever I go back to it, I want to change it all. I've been writing all these years, and it's hard to, you know, in my kind of double existence, you know, in two languages, in two cultures, in two worlds, I'm a different person. I address different people, you know, different kind of audience, different profile of audience. So that I have to figure it out in my head, how to put it out. But I actually decided I decided to put out the second half of my book. And that will come out and I think I will self-publish it. And it will be a book about it's a book about my experiences in America. So it's the second part of my book. But that main book, I'm still deliberating, you know. I wrote it in English, and I'm very, the thing is, when you write about such an experience, about the war, right, that completely divided people, divided families, divided, you know, people, husbands and wives and brothers and sisters and so on. It's an unbelievable amount of responsibility. And I'm, you know, this baggage, this responsibility weighs on me. And so I have to deal with all that, you know. And I was thinking, not that in any way I would even think of comparing myself to him, but Mark Twain, for example, wanted his autobiography to be published 100 years after his death. So that's one of the options. I mean, because I'm so tired of all the controversy that I constantly cause in my country. You know, whenever I just had a, just now, actually, I had one of those things happen, you know, where I say something and then it's taken out of context, you know, put in all the media with this incredibly malicious kind of context that is superimposed on my words, right? Mm. And that creates such a, you know, a feeling that I just cannot get through, right? That I'm not being heard, mm. right? So it's tough.
I suppose, right, it's a difficult time as well, I think, because I think we live in a time where it's very difficult to have any kind of nuance in conversation or in discourse. I think, obviously, things, you know, everybody blames social media, but I think there is validity to that, that it's very difficult to have conversations where there is any kind of nuance and it isn't just one side sort of versus another. But I mean, I suppose just to sort of return to the biographical tract here a little bit. I mean, you found yourself in America in the early 90s. And am I correct in understanding that your early experiences in America were on stage? I mean, did you join the Actors Studio, I believe, in the early 90s?
Yes. My first job in America was on a play called Yerma, mm-hmm. And I played the title character, and it was a play, it's a famous play, kind of an interestingly feminist play by Federico Garcia Lorca, the anti-fascist mm-hmm. Spanish writer who was killed by the fascists. But it's from a you know, the story is told from a female's from a woman's point of view, and in the end, she kills her husband. And I remember in Indianapolis, we did it in Indianapolis, that people were actually cheering at the end, you know. Wow. American audiences were like, yeah, you know, and I was completely shocked.
Another world.
Another world where people in the theater cheer.
Was the theater a comfort to you at the time with that transition?
Comfort. Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, there were many issues that I had to solve at that time. First of all, my papers, right? My whole immigration status and so on. And that theater did a lot of work on my behalf, and I'm very grateful for that. And then the Babylon 5 pilot came in, and that's how it all started.
You must have just thought, I mean, looking at your early days in America, when you'd moved here in the early 90s, you must have thought, this is wonderful. They're giving away roles at the airport. I've got theatre work. I've got this TV show. I mean, that all happened so quickly for you. That must have been very, very encouraging, I'd imagine, at the time.
Sure. You know, suddenly I found that I lost everything. I came without anything. And suddenly there was another community, first of all, my tribe, at least that's how I saw it or them. At that time, I'm no longer, I mean, I don't feel it anymore that strongly, but those are the people that I belong to. You know, I came to the Babylon 5 set, and suddenly I knew the people I knew. I mean, I didn't know them, but I knew them, right, from my former life. Those were my people, the gaffer, the, you know, the dolly puller, and, you know, the focus puller. I mean, I was home. You know, I came home in a way, and the theater also, right? Those were my communities, my people, my environment. At the same time, everything was completely different. I had to function in a different language, in a different culture. You know, I was shocked in theater and at the shooting for Babylon 5. I was absolutely shocked, primarily by the speed that people work here, right? I mean, tuck, 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 you know, time is money, that whole thing. I lived in a socialist country. We didn't have money, but we did have time. Oh, yes, we did have time. So time was, you know.
And I hear as well, I mean, from I remember hearing a story. Funnily enough, Mira, you and I actually met many years ago, very briefly.
Really?
Yeah, I'm going to show my true colours here. I attended a Babylon 5 convention back in the 90s, back when the show was on the air, in Blackpool in England. It was around.
That was the time.
That was when everything.
We were the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, yeah. I'd heard, you know, my favourite TV show was having this big convention. I've talked about this on the show before. before, actually, and I spoke to Claudia a little bit about this, because this was when a lot of things went down with Claudia that weekend, obviously, with the contracts and all of that stuff. That was happening at that convention.
Right. I know. I remember. Oh, my God. I remember so many details.
Yeah. very, very, very exciting.
Remember.
And I know that you, Pat, and Claudia do a lot of things together as well, so I'm sure that you guys have a lot of fun with those stories. But it's funny, because I remember that was around the time... It was towards the end of season 4 of Babylon 5, and it was changing networks, and there was a lot of changes going
right.
on. But as you say before, I mean, you guys, that was a following, and fandom and conventions have changed a lot over the years. But that was the first time that I ever saw a show, not just science fiction, but a show itself being celebrated to that level. What was it like being a part of that? What was it like being a rock star?
That was incredible. I remember us getting on stage. That moment I'll never forget, you know, and 80,000 people were in the audience cheering us and adoring us. So, you know, it was a good feeling. but, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting. Behind the stage, behind it all, was a whole other agenda happening, and I was absolutely shocked when Claudia didn't come back. I mean, I couldn't understand that. I still can't, but oh well.
It's a funny business. I mean, the reason I bring it up was that, I mean, you were speaking to this idea of time luxury, of cinema, rehearsal, television. And I think it's fair to say, and I think Joe Straczynski said from stage in Blackpool about how, even by television standards, Babylon 5 had a very accelerated production schedule. Just wondering, I mean, you know, you were on that show for 5 years. You know, you this wasn't like these days of basic cable of 10 episodes. You were putting out 20, 25 of these a year. What was that like? What was that work schedule? I mean, you spoke before about the initial, I suppose, language barriers or culture barriers. Did you just strap in for those 5 years and kind of ride it out? What was that experience like?
Well, I mean, it was great, you know. I had to get up at 3 o'clock, right? I mean, 2:30 actually, 2:30. Wow. I remember that, you know, looking at my alarm clock by the bed and seeing that weird picture and not knowing whether I'm going to bed or I'm just waking up. What's going on? Is it day or is it night or what am I doing? You know, but then you drive to the set through the completely dark city and you feel that you're doing something for yourself, for your family. I mean, you know, you're a worker. I felt as a worker, you know, night shift worker. The people, I mean, you heard that from so many of us. But really, what is different and what is extraordinary with this show is that we somehow liked each other. Truly liked each other and stayed real friends in real life. You know, we call each other. We're there for each other. If anybody is in trouble, we'll come. I know that. If I call Pat Tolman or if I call Bill Mumy, you know, if a thief comes to my house, I know these people. Claudia too. You know, those are people that are there for me, and I'm there for them, and that's almost unheard of. I mean, I worked so much in my life, you know, on both continents, and I've never experienced that. Never. I've never stayed in touch with the whole cast of a show that I did, of a movie that I did. Never.
And I think you can see that.
Really?
I mean, yeah, I think. I mean, it's funny. You're as an actor, you'll probably be mortified to hear this, but the outtakes, the blooper reels from Babylon 5 are quite available out there, and that gives you a real glimpse as to the relationships and the atmosphere on the set, you know. And it's a real great snapshot. I'd just like to talk a little bit, I suppose, specifically about the character of Delenn. I mean, it's been discussed before about how Joe Straczynski was a great receptor of information, and would incorporate elements of your experiences and the historical sort of geopolitical contexts that you had found yourself in. I'm just wondering a little bit about that, but also And this is such a novice non-actor question, but is the process of creating an alien character with all of the connotations and the lack of cultural context a different process to creating a character who would exist under more normal circumstances? Is it more collaborative? Right. How does that work?
Interesting. Well, my answer would be not really, yeah. Right? Because the only thing that you have as an actor, you know, is you. I mean, it's your experience. So that's what you use. But this feeling that you know, how would I say that? That you're kind of removed from, let's say, ordinary life to a certain degree, you know, the banality of ordinary humans, that was there, right? It's a little bit elevated, I think, in the way I did it and in the way I saw that character, you know? when I think about her costumes, that silky dresses, she was a little bit above the ground, you know, and I appreciate
that. Yeah, Delenn didn't walk, she floated, didn't she? She floated through scenes. that ethereal sort of elven quality. And it's interesting because, I mean, the character did change. I mean, not just in the sense of us learning more about the character and the natural evolution that the story arc brought out, but I suppose also there was a significantly visual difference to the character in the pilot. There was an androgynous element of the character, and I'm just wondering was that change brought on by yourself? Was that around the makeup, or was that just a natural story evolution? What was the sort of the chronology of that?
Right. It's interesting that you ask me that. People ask that a lot, thinking that we actors have that much power, right? I mean, sure. I'm sure that Tom Cruise has that power. but, you know, I mean, in fact, only once did I go to John Straczynski's office and told him about my problems with my eyes. You know, I developed this thing with my eyes where they were tearing and they were hurt and so on from all the makeup just above my eyes, you know, that was the makeup that was covering my eyebrows. And so I humbly begged that he, you know, liberates me from that piece that covers my eyebrows. And I'll never forget the sentence that he told me. When he saw me humbly begging, he said, "Impossible. Minbaris don't have eyebrows." Period. That was the end.
You can't argue with logic like that, can you?
You know, who would know about how Minbaris look? But Joe, you know, but that was the line that was not to be crossed.
and I suppose also you had the solidarity of your colleagues who were also made up, because I think that one of the things that is most commonly said about Babylon 5, and this is no slight on any of the actors who don't fall into this category, but is the quality of actors in the alien roles is really quite remarkable. And I'm just wondering if you've got any thoughts about that. Is that coincidence, or is that just that to act through makeup requires a focus and an intensity that it just seems to me that, I mean, even not just, you know, the key roles of yourself and Andreas and Peter, who I think anybody would agree put in, you know, remarkable sort of transformative performances that evolve and have nuance and levels. Why is that? Why is the alien acting in Babylon 5 so astonishing?
Wow. Well, first of all, thank you, thank you, thank you. I mean, it's beautiful. So nice to hear, you know, that somebody actually sees it, right? Because, you know, when you went, I mean, when I went to, I don't know, search for another agent, let's say, which I was doing at the time of Babylon 5, you know, these agents would say, "Oh, but what are you playing on Babylon 5? Oh, you're an alien." You know, it was dismissed. It was kind of a second-class citizen among actors. Mm. It's interesting, you know, kind of the racism that is so prevailing everywhere was also present in the way that the, you know, alien actors were treated. I remember at one point, you know, it's all, as always, it's all very subtle, right? But it's not taken as seriously as the non-alien acting. You know, that's the truth. Absolutely. It's interesting.
And that's ironic as well, because if you look at the merchandising and the marketing of the show, it's those alien characters that are front and center in the selling of the shows.
Interesting, right. You know, but not in the respect, let's say, that you got, right? And the appreciation. It's a strange discipline. It's hard. You know, the alien makeup, I had to adjust my whole way of thinking about acting and about myself. And it was a learning process, right? You know, the my makeup in the pilot was absolutely horrific. Mm. I mean, I was deeply unhappy. But then I told myself, and Andreas told me a crucial thing. I was unhappy, you know, sitting there in this, looking like a monster, you know, and when people would approach me, they would always like issue this startled little sigh, like, huh? You know, that kind of thing. So it's not that pleasant when people do that when they see you, you know, it's a little, okay, that's me. All right. And who am I? You know, I mean, you're so used to, I mean, the main thing in this profession is to use your face, right? So suddenly you have no face, right? So where are you? What do you do? What are you doing? All these questions. It's an existential question, you know, really like deep, deep question. But Andreas came to me and said, Mira, just remember, all theater, all acting started with masks, you know, in ancient Greece.
Mm. Andreas was Greek, wasn't he? So, I mean, he was qualified to make that statement.
He would always invoke our connection, you know, we're neighbors. We're neighbors. Yeah. We stick to each other.
The European contingent.
The European connection. And the Balkans connection.
Yeah, of course.
Even more specific. Mm. And he would always say to me, you know, just be calm. Andreas never complained, never, about anything.
He looked like he had a great time on that show.
The scorching heat, I mean, you know, Southern California, I mean, the heat, unbelievable. We were there in the hottest part of Los Angeles and, you know, covered with all that latex. I mean, you can imagine how your body feels. And he would come to me and said, just calm down, you know. Remember the old ladies in our countries, you know, how they put in the middle of the summer, they always dress in black, you know, in black, covered their heads and everything. And Andreas said, you know why? I didn't know. Why? Because the sweat cools you down.
Wow, that's a useful context.
Remember that. That's a brutal one.
Yeah. Well, the next time I'm experiencing some mild first world discomfort, I will remember Andreas. I will invoke Andreas's wise words. I've got a quick question, I suppose, about process, because I would imagine that it's very tempting to make connections between theatre and television, but I would imagine that it'd be extremely different as well, in the sense that. Playing a character like Delenn for 5 years, for example, and living with that character, is that in any way similar to the experience of living with a character over a prolonged engagement in the theatre? Or does the fact that a play has a static text that is the same night after night change that experience of living with the character?
Mm-hmm. Interesting questions. Yes, in a way it's similar. It's a known territory that you tread, that you enter. You're the territory of your character that has been established. So, but theater, yes, you're right. Although it's the same template, it's the same text, it's the same words, it's the same movements. In theater, it's never the same. You try new things. Every day is a new day, and you are new and different. So that's what you have to explore, and that's what you have to focus on, because otherwise it becomes grueling, and you don't have any fun or any inspiration to do it. But and that's a problem a little bit with doing a series for such a long time. You know, you get to be even almost too comfortable. You know, it's like getting into your old shoes, into your old slippers. So you have to be wary of that. You have to be aware of that can happen, that you would somehow think, I've done it so many times. Who cares?
And that comfort, I'm just wondering, do you, as far as how much of that you take home, do you ever, it's going to sound like a very silly question, but do you ever dream as your characters? Do you ever have that level of internal sort of experience?
That's interesting. Wow, what an interesting question. That is something that I'll think about, you know. That's an interesting writing assignment.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, when we'll have you back on when your book comes out, and we can pick that one up.
I like that one. I'm not sure. I have many in the past, when I was intensely working in theater, I had those typical actor's dreams, these nightmares where I can't find the stage, where I'm roaming around the dark corridors and halls, and I hear my cue, and I know that I have to be on stage, but I can't get there, and the panic rises, you know, that sort of dreams. Or you wake up on the stage, the curtain goes up and there's audience, and you have no idea what play it is, what you're supposed to say or do, and it's this feeling of, you know, I want to die, you know. Like, what's happening? It's mostly the panic filled dreams, sure, that I have about acting.
The preparation anxiety. It's interesting as well, because I think that there's I introduced my wife to Babylon 5 recently, and she adored it as well. She's not a science fiction fan, but she just loved the drama of it, and the richness of the characters in the universe. And
beautiful.
One of the things that I noticed in your work in general, Mira, is I see a lot of moral complexity. For example, the family in Emir Krista's work are, for example, quite harmful often in their actions, but ultimately pull together in that way that families do. And Delenn as well, the character of Delenn has such a kind of, I suppose, like a defiant strength, but also I think crucially in this time, which is one of the reasons why I think Babylon 5 remains to be timely, the vulnerability to admit her mistakes and sort of wrong-headedness, which I think is in short supply these days. I mean, what that makes me think too is, I mean, myself as a white man have found that art, things like Babylon 5, characters like Delenn, have helped me sort of traverse being able to look at my own worldview and to start to understand that my worldview is coloured by privilege. And I'm just curious, and I think this speaks to your perhaps your concerns about releasing your book. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are of this idea of cancel culture that we hear a lot about, this idea of people having these things that they've maybe said or done in their youth or when they were different people, and being held accountable for those, which, you know, arguably people should. But at the same time, do you feel that prevents growth, that discourages people from having the comfort to admit that they've changed and what they thought before wasn't? Because that's something I see in your work a lot, and it just got me to thinking that when I was rewatching some of your films.
So interesting. Your questions, I mean, I have to give you praise. I mean, your questions have such depth.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, the moral questions are such a big part of me, you know, and I'm just, you know, I'm writing a blog. I just want to tell you that, and it's on my website, and it's the website is miraferland.net.
Awesome.
So I encourage people to see what I write. I also write a column for a paper in Serbia, and so I do a lot of writing right now. And I'm trying to figure it out. You know, writing for me is a way to deal with all those things, right? Where is our responsibility? You know, I right now I see so many parallels between the world that was collapsing before the war, started in the former Yugoslavia and what's happening all around the world, you know, with this movement towards right, you know, with this, you know, people think it's a word that's used too much. I think it's a word that's not used enough, and that's fascism. You know, fascism's coming at us through all the cracks, you know, in the whole world.
Never gone.
So it's a danger. I mean, we live in incredibly dangerous times, and I feel that I really feel the responsibility to do something about it. You know, almost like a warning. You know, because I hear the same words, the same hateful, divisive agenda right now in America and all over the, you know, Europe, Eastern Europe, Hungary, Poland, and so on and so forth. It's a dangerous world that we are living in because the genie has been let out of the bottle. And my experience in the former Yugoslavia tells me that genies that have been let out don't go in by themselves. You know, we'll have to deal with that. And on top of all that, this corona thing, which is actually accelerating and deepening all the trends that we already have. You know, the division, the closing of the borders. It's the dream come true for all authoritarian leaders.
Yeah, I mean, who'd have thought that a pandemic could be politicized? I mean, that seemed, you'd have thought that that would have been unifying. And I think that art has such an important role in this, because I find that, I mean, I say, and again, I say this from a place of privilege as a white man, that somebody lecturing me or telling me isn't going to change the way I view the world, but perhaps a character in a science fiction TV series who I like, through metaphor, can teach me these lessons about self-reflection and about how there's strength in admitting one's mistakes, and that isn't a weakness, I think is as powerful now and important now as it ever has been.
Yeah, it's true. I totally agree. Yes. And that's why we need art. Absolutely.
I'm also curious as well that in the one of the other things that I see a lot in your characters, and I think this is very central to Delaine, is a sense of defiant strength. And I'm just wondering how you conjure that, because Paul, my regular co-host, who will be kicking himself that he isn't here today, by the way, has often talked about what a wonderful, what he calls open-faced actor you are. And about how there's an ability that you have, Mira, to just convey so much with a look and convey shock and disappointment and those sort of complex, more complex relationships with a look. How do you conjure that? How do you bring that out?
Oh, you're thank you. Such lovely words. I mean, I appreciate them so much. You know, acting is like living. You know, you are who you are, and you if there is an openness, as you said, and this transparency that comes from me. I mean, it's nothing that I, you know, fabricate or put together. You know,
or learn.
Right. It's just who I am. You know, and if that comes through in my work, then that's the greatest compliment that you can give me. You know. That it all comes together and you really are, you know, on that screen, you bring that humanity, I think. And that, you know, I hope that's visible. And you then when you tell me it is, I feel happy. And you know,
yeah,
that's my reward.
It's quite remarkable. And I think I'm also wondering, who are your heroes, Mira, either in acting or just in the world? Who are the people that you do or have looked up to?
Right. You know, I think so much of it, you know, and that's a big part of my book, my books. You know, why did I choose America? How did I see America as a young person living in Eastern Europe? I fell in love with the ideas, but what are these ideas? And now that I live here, I see a whole other part, and I see how deluded we were in so many ways. But I also see that we knew something that is, you know, America is a possibility. It's not a reality, really. And we fell in love, or I fell in love, with that possibility, right? Will it ever come true? We don't know. I don't know, my heroes, I mean, there's, okay, immediately you ask me that, and there's an answer that immediately comes out of my head, and that's Martin Luther King. I mean, it seems so ordinary, right? But that, you know, the humanity and the you know, this, he, for me, he, you know, and people like him, so the rebels, the alternative, that's America for me. That's what I fell in love with, right? I don't know, Bob Dylan. I mean, you know, I thought that Bob Dylan could be the president. Let him be the president of America. But is that a realistic, is that a truthful vision of this country? I doubt it, you know. However, that's what came to me. That's what I, that's what my brain and my heart, you know, got. I mean, this braveness and the ideas. Anyway, I could go on. It's such a, it's a big subject, right? But I always responded, you know, I teach at a film school, and I teach dramatic literature, and one of the pieces that I teach, the plays that I teach, is Antigone, right, by Sophocles. So I tell my students, you know, read the first play ever written about the need for civil disobedience.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah, you know, politics happened to me. I was kind of thrown into it without my will. I happened to be in the place that was in, that became incredibly politicized because of the circumstances around me. But I needed to act. You know, there was, you're thrown in a situation where you have to make a choice, and I did. And that's, and I, in a way, it brought me to who I am right now, right? And it's not about politics. It's about morality, I would say, you know. These are moral issues, you know.
I mean, a lot of the time people will use the excuse of, oh, let's not talk about politics. But I think that now, everybody in the world, everybody's politicized. The communication being what it is means that conversations that were considered politics now are just conversations. But I'd imagine also, I mean the sheer diversity of experience that you must have had, not just geographically, but also with people as well. I mean, you spoke earlier about the Andreas, for example, and your the similarity of your experiences from a sort of geography perspective, and the cast of Babylon 5. But I'd also imagine this world of fandom, this world of conventions, and all of these things. And I spoke to Patricia Torman, who's very, very actively involved in that world. I'm just wondering, have you forged relationships in that world as well? Because I'd imagine that you'd be interacting with other actors from other shows and other participants. So if you could just tell me a little bit about your experiences in that world.
I mean, you know, conventions. Okay, my first convention, I told that story, so maybe I'm going to, you know, repeat myself. But my first ever convention in my whole life was in Stony Brook, New York. And me and Michael O'Hare were the guests. And that was immediately after we shot the pilot. And I remember talking about the war and how I came here. And I said something, I had to start from zero. And, you know, it's like losing your family. I use that comparison. And somebody from the audience shouted at me, but you found another family, you know.
Oh,
you found your new family. That's what he said. You found your new family.
What an introduction.
And right. And it's interesting, you know, how sometimes random people say random things, that really stay with you. You know, they're stuck in your mind. You know, some random person in the street says something and forever you remember it forever, right? And that's one of those sentences that I remembered forever. And, you know, and it really, it kind of stopped me in my tracks. And I looked at that person and I saw this huge amount of people looking at me and being there for me and really listening to me and really kind of getting it, getting my story, right? And I thought, that's what happened. Yes.
Well, that's wonderful.
I found my new family. I mean, I never, you know, Pat is the queen of fandom, and she actually is creating a business and a whole enterprise.
Pat knows everybody, doesn't she? It's incredible.
Like everybody personally. I mean, she knows where people live and, you know, what they like to eat. I mean, you know, also, I have a problem with Facebook, ideological problems. It's very hard to, oh my God, it's very hard to function in this world, you know, right now for me. Because, but anyway, I'm learning, and we did this thing together, Pat and Claudia and me, and that was fabulous. I loved it because I love the, you know, the banding of three women. I believe in female power and us being friends and collaborators and not competitors.
That makes me think. You mentioned the three women thing, and there's a moment. I don't know if you're familiar with. Are you familiar with the concept of the Bechdel test?
Absolutely, yes.
I teach it, and I'm preaching to the choir here, but there was a moment when I was rewatching Babylon 5 recently with my wife. There was a moment, and it's a tiny moment that doesn't draw attention to itself, and I don't think it was even designed to do this, where yourself, Claudia and Patricia on the bridge of a starship, I think the White Star. And there's no men in this thing. Like, this was like 1996, I think, this episode was shot. And there's no men in this scene. And these three women are doing this stuff. None of it's about men. They're not talking about men. And it seemed so organically. And I honestly believe, I don't think that Joe, when he wrote that scene, was consciously going, I will now get my liberal quill out and pen a scene for these three actresses. I think that was just where the story went, and these characters were in the position for this. And I think for something like that to happen in an unspoken way, then, is in such an unselfconscious way, is really incredible.
Yeah, it is. It is. There was that in Babylon 5. I mean, it was ahead of its time in so many ways, I think.
This is a Babylon 5 question, but I think that it could probably apply to a lot of your work and to acting in general. I was just wondering if there's any scenes in Babylon 5 or any moments that really jumped off the page or that perhaps didn't really resonate with you when you read them but came alive when performed, you know, that magic trick that can sometimes happen. I was wondering if there's any moments like that.
You know, there was this moment starring Andreas, of course, who else, right? What was the episode? I don't remember the episode. It was a conversation between us about whether it's justified to kill a million people in order to save 3 billion people, right? So that that was the discussion. And when I read that scene at home, I thought, right, yeah, like a theoretical discussion about, you know, about that. A theoretical intellectual discussion about numbers and justification of doing bad things in order to, you know, for a greater good, blah, blah, blah. So I learned my lines. I came, you know, one of those scenes that you kind of don't think too much. It's just a little conversation. And as I said, theoretical, intellectual debate. So I come to the stage and we sit down on opposite sides of the table, Andreas and I, and the rehearsal starts. And suddenly, the amount of emotion, the amount of anguish in Andreas talking about that dilemma completely shocked me. It was a completely different scene than what I read at home. I didn't see the potential. I didn't see the hidden emotional turmoil, right? That was also a part of that scene. But there was no discussion. It's not that we discussed the scene. Not at all. He just did it and lifted me up. You know, I truly understood what it means when actors say, you know, what a wonderful experience it is and what a life-changing experience it is to work with a really, really honest and you know, how would I say, present actor, right? And with an actor with such an emotional depth. And how it lifts you, it makes you better. So that's what happened. And suddenly I was there, you know, I, because I was present too. And so he lifted me, he led me. We were both in tears, you know, inside the scene, in the scene. Wow. And I realized what it was, you know, what these numbers represented, what was behind them, you know. Unbelievable. So that was one of those things that happened.
Yeah, that's amazing.
In the moment. In the
scene. Wow, I'm going to go actually, and watch that scene now.
Yes. I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, I don't know if the scene, you know, if my description, I'm telling you about my internal feelings.
I know the moment you're speaking to, and it is a very powerful, right. Sort of quietly powerful moment. And this speaks to this idea of, I mean, that's true. What you're describing there is a true act of creation. I mean, I know Joe's words were there, and that there was power in those words. But I mean, I've spoke before about, Emir Kusturica's work and the idea of things just coming out of the ether. That feels like one of those moments.
Right. It's true. That's the magic, you know, that you're searching. That's why you're doing it. You know, these are these moments that have this bliss that lifts you up from ordinary life. And, you know, that's kind of why I chose this profession, right? What mesmerized me as a very young person on that stage when I did a high school production that changed my life. And interestingly enough, the teacher that did it with us in high school, so, you know, talking about Zagreb, Croatia, former Yugoslavia, socialist country. So here comes a young English teacher who just finished Oxford, you know, a breath of a completely different world. And he decides to do a play with us. And we rehearse this play every weekend for a year.
Oh, my goodness.
And we do it in English. So my first acting experience in my whole life was in English.
Oh, my goodness.
And it truly changed my life. I truly had like a religious experience on that stage. Whew, it hit me, you know, the adrenaline, the excitement, the magic, the transportation to another level, you know. That's kind of the transcendence of the experience. That's, I think, what made it for me. It's truly, I mean, it's interesting, you know. It's always throughout the history, acting and especially actresses were always, you know, theater was always deemed as the profane thing, right? Like, you know, actors were buried, you know, in the Middle Ages, actors were buried outside the fortress walls because they were disrespectable, especially women, right? We know all that. But there is this religious aspect to that realm. I truly feel it, right? This being transported into a different dimension, sort of.
I can't imagine a more rewarding life than chasing transcendence, chasing that feeling, that experience,
pursuing it. Well, there are other aspects that are awful, awful. I mean, so horrible and so soul crashing that you kind of you know, you sometimes you say, okay, never mind that epiphany and that, transcendence. I can live without it. Just leave me in
but
peace.
But then you get a taste of it again and you're like, oh, but there it is. I remember this. I remember being that young girl on that stage and feeling alive and feeling in touch with these things and
that
an amazing thing. But I think that's a great place to finish off. And thank you so much for your time here. It's so generous and such a thrill. And an honor
Thank
for me
you.
To have a conversation with you.
Oh my
as
God.
I say,
you're the most wonderful interviewer. You made my day. I needed it today. I'm dealing with all kinds of things, and so I needed it. And thank you for your kindness and lovely words and true understanding.
Oh, I really appreciate that. And again, just there are so many people out there who are still so appreciative of your work in sort of both in America and in Europe. And, you know, thanks for bringing so much humanity into our lives, Mira. So you have a great day. And if I could just ask you just to remind our listeners where they can find you on the internet again and read the writing that you made mention of earlier.
Yes, mirafurlan.net. That's my website. And I also am on Twitter, @FurlanMira. And, oh, my God, I was introduced to Instagram, but I can't quite connect to the thing. So
I'm right there with you on that one, Mira. I'm not used to this.
I'm doing it. I there are two pictures of my cats, but Twitter also has a big problem, you know, the hate mail and so on, but I'm not reading it. So, I have a special way of doing it anyway.
But okay. we'll look for your work out in those venues. And it'd be great to have you back on again when you do release your next project. And thanks again so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
All the best. You have a great
day.
Thank you,
everybody. And thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This podcast is part of the Pod Syndicate family. For more criminally compelling shows, articles, and conversations, head to wearepodsyndicate.com.